I'm so glad we're back to normal now. Now I can go to work, I can show my teeth, I can smile all day long.
Welcome to the Telling It Our Way podcast. I'm Allie.
And I'm Becca. In this podcast, we bring you stories by disabled people about disabled people. Stories from the lives of self-advocates with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
These are real people with complicated lives. They don't want your pity, and they do not exist to inspire you.
That's right. This is not inspiration porn.
Hey, Becca. So today we're talking about connection.
Yeah, that's right. So we're talking about how people connect with their communities, how people build relationships with each other. And we have two different stories today, and they're two really different circumstances, but they're really both about this kind of need and desire to form connection with other people.
Yeah, I'm really excited because I think these stories will hit our listeners regardless of how you relate to disability or not. So we're going to be talking about what happens when the world shuts down with a global pandemic and we're all isolated.
For example.
And we're going to be talking about strategies and struggles with public transportation and getting around town.
Yeah, and just getting out of the house, right? And how important that can be. But before we do any of that, do you want to hear some statistics?
Are they from the National Core Indicators?
Oh, you know they are. Yeah, so I
lay it on me.
I thought it would be useful to talk a little bit about, in general, kind of how people with developmental disabilities feel. So again, the National Core Indicators, if you're new here, they are a wonderful kind of set of metrics that are conducted every year with people with developmental disabilities about all sorts of things. But they have a particular section of this survey that is specifically about inclusion and belonging, and another about community and participation. So I just pulled some stats from there today. And so the first thing that I just want to point to is that on average, only about 70% of people with developmental disabilities who are surveyed say that they actually get to go out and do the things that they want to do in the community as much as they want to.
So that means 30% of people are not getting out and doing the things that they want to do in the community.
Yeah. And in fact, in a question that asks, you know, in the past month, how many times did you go out for any kind of entertainment, right? Going out to eat, going to a concert, going out dancing, whatever it might be, 30% of people said they didn't get to go anywhere at all in the past month.
So somebody might be lucky if they are able to go to and from work and then they spend the rest of their time in their apartment.
Exactly, right? And so how do you form a community connection? How do we advocate for thinking about things like inclusion in our communities when people can't even get out of their houses?
Well, that really reminds me of Phyllis's story. So Phyllis is going to talk to us about a time when connection was really hard during the COVID pandemic and how she learned to stay connected in a new way with her community.
Oh, great. Let's listen.
My name is Phyllis, and this is my story. I like to go out shopping. I like to go to restaurants. I also like to go out to eat. I work at Kroger. Back in 2020, we had a pandemic. Before the pandemic, I used to go to work and everything was fine. But I got scared. I had to wear a mask at work. I thought I was going to catch COVID. People at my store were fighting over milk, water, toilet paper, and paper towels. You only could get two of each. We weren't able to do anything. Everything shut down. Special Olympics, Salute, and People First. I almost cried. I thought my life was going to be over. Me and Darius were home alone. We ordered in for food. We were so alone we had nothing to do. Cassandra called and texted me and asked me, could you get on the internet? I said, sure. I had no idea what it was. Before the pandemic, I did everything with other people. I never did anything online. I didn't even have a computer. I had to use my phone for Zoom. In 2020, I used my stimulus money. I bought a computer. We also got something to cook at home. On the internet, we had track and game nights. We also had dances. I really like watching Jordan cook. He cooked some awesome food. We were having fun. We weren't watching TV all night. I joined Wellness Buddies. I called people to check on them once a week. And I know both of them now. I met them in person. My family would call and ask how I was doing. I said, everything was fine. I'm living through this time. I'm thankful for people that want to get the vaccines. The reason I'm telling this story is because we didn't do anything, and I'm glad we're able to get back together now. I told people to get on. I'm so glad we're back to normal now. Now I can go to work, I can show my teeth. I can smile all day long.
All right. Thank you so much for that story from Phyllis. I think there's just so much to unpack there. But first, I just kind of maybe wanted to start by thinking about what was the experience of people with developmental disabilities during COVID. There's some things that we know, right? So we know, for example, that people with developmental disabilities were much more vulnerable to contracting COVID and to dying from COVID for all sorts of reasons, whether that be, you know, physiological reasons, like people with developmental disabilities were more likely to have secondary conditions like respiratory disease or diabetes that could lead to complications, but also a whole bunch of social factors, right?
Yeah, I'm wondering how many people with disabilities and intellectual disabilities were essential workers working in grocery stores or working in places where, I mean, that's certainly Phyllis's story.
Yeah, right. Or people who live in congregate settings, right? If you live in a group home or a nursing home or something like that, you're much more vulnerable to contracting an infectious illness. But beyond that, right, beyond the actually kind of getting COVID, we also know that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities had a really hard time for a lot of different reasons, right? So there were a lot of program closures. Phyllis talks about this in her story. She said, I thought my life was ending. And so a lot of the time when all of your relationships with people come through formal services, whether that's like a day program or something else, when those services end, so do your social relationships.
And when people are hesitant about taking public transportation to get somewhere, or you rely on public spaces to gather because you live in smaller apartments or something like that, that also becomes a barrier to gathering with people.
Yeah, so there have been a whole bunch of studies that have come out since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic that said that people with developmental disabilities were much more likely to experience adverse mental health side effects like stress or confusion. And so I've actually done a little bit of research on this myself. I have a paper coming out this year about people's experiences of the early pandemic. And, you know, Phyllis talks about using the internet as a way to kind of connect with people. That's a pretty common story, but we also have to take into account that people with developmental disabilities are a lot less likely to have access to the internet than their non-disabled peers.
Yeah, it looks like that the national core indicators have asked some of these questions about equal access to things like the internet and having computer access at home and being able to get online.
Yeah, exactly. So only 63% of people with developmental disabilities say they use the internet every day. And I would say, in addition to that, what I found in my research is that even if people have access to the technology, they don't always have support to use it. And so I just pulled one quote from somebody that I talked to because I think this is really important. This is from somebody who, in my research, I call her Shelley. That's not her real name. She is, in addition to having a developmental disability, she is blind. And so she had access to the internet, but she didn't have anybody in her group home who would help her figure out how to connect to the Zooms that she was supposed to be on. And so she would often rely on people calling her in via voice phone and trying to connect that way. And things just really weren't working for her. And what she said to me is that she felt like nobody cared. She said, I just felt, well, nobody cares to do it. Nobody cares to do this with me. And I felt in general, nobody cared about doing it. And it just felt all distance. And it was horrible. And so she thinks about, it's not just the technology, it's also the human support that's kind of missing.
Being able to meaningfully navigate with that technology.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's something in Phyllis's story that I think is so important. And it's when she says, you know, that now that we can get back to things in real life, that is important to do. And we know that we now have a generation where we teach college students, right? Mm-hmm. So we know we have a generation of college students who are very comfortable online and are much less likely to show up for any in-person events, whether it's on college or in other social settings. But I think what Phyllis reminds us is that these in-person events are really important events. And that sort of helps me pivot a little bit to our next story, mm-hmm. which is about trying to get places in person and how difficult that can be.
Yes, that's great. So we're going to hear from Matthew now, who's talking about the way that knowing and navigating the bus system where he lives has really helped open up his world.
My name is Matthew Riley. I work at Myers. When I'm not working, I like staying inside and playing video games and looking things up on my laptop. I take the bus all the time. I have a limited bus pass. It's a very rare one. It's unlimited till 2099. I remember every bus schedule. I put it on my phone so I know what time the buses arrive, and I keep track of them. That way I don't have to look up the schedule every time I'm downtown, and that way when someone asks me, I know automatically. I started taking the bus with my mom when I was 2 or 3 years old. My mom taught me to take the bus growing up because we always went back and forth to the hospitals. I was very sick at that time. I was going to a lot of hospitals. She taught me all the different routes. She used to read to me on the bus because she didn't want me hearing what the people were talking about. My mom read to me Dr. Seuss, Bernstein Bears, and anything with heroes or fairy tale story, anything like good books. I learned to take the bus by myself in elementary school. I think 5th or 6th grade, I rode the bus for a while. Let's just say I had a lot of problems on the school bus with other students. I had to get off the school bus for a while for my own safety. So I took the city bus in the morning, then after school. I was nervous at first because I was little and by myself, especially going back and forth to school. I was always worried about not being on time or being there too early when I didn't want to be there at all. To get my bus pass, I had to go to the building downtown. I had to go to a navigation test and a quiz. They asked me different questions, where everything was and how I got there. The navigator lady was impressed with my skills. I got very lucky because the lady was very impressed with how I knew everything and said, I'm going to give you a rare bus pass. Not many get this, but you're going to have it. A lot of car people have expiration dates, mine doesn't. When I started my job at Myers, I started being real anxious because I knew I had to be there at a certain time and the bus was new to me. I knew the route, I knew the buses, but I'd never seen the route before. I was kind of afraid to travel by myself over there, being myself going that far away. But over time, I started to learn that, oh, this is not bad. I can make it on my own. I don't need someone to take me at all. On the bus, you're free from car restraints and all the other mess of headaches I got. It's a good thing now I got unlimited bus pass. Why ruin that? Because cars were just a headache to me. I understand cars get people around, but there are a lot of pros and cons with that, like traffic, cops, cars breaking down, car accidents on the bus. I know I'm safer. When I'm not going to work, I try to find places away from my house where I can isolate and be by myself for a while. My favorite spot right now is Far Hospital because it's very calm out there. The surrounding. Sometimes I go to Far Hospital and I get too upset at home and I don't want to deal with everything. I just go out there, turn my phone off and leave at home. If I have to, I'll have my watch on me to keep track of the time. I know the bus will be out there every hour. I know when I get on the bus, my headache staff can't follow me there. I know they won't get in a car to follow me because they know the consequences. Lucky for me, they don't know any buses at all. Without the bus, I'm totally fracked. Like, I have no access to buses. I would not be able to get to work at all. I would not be able to escape my house and go around and have my alone time. I would not be able to go to the store and get my video games. I'd be basically stuck at home. I'd lose my mind if I had to be trapped with 3 roommates every day. I wouldn't be able to escape. I understand when you get frustrated and wait for the bus. It's not showing up on time. I understand. The bus is under time constraints and also traffic and trains, but they will be there. Some drivers can be grumpy, but you gotta understand that the job they go through every day is basically isn't kind to them. But if you're nice to the driver, sometimes they will say hi to you back. They will talk to you. Let you know, I talk to the people downtown in the morning when I get on the bus, especially my morning driver, she knows me. She goes, you don't need to show me your bus card because I know you have it. You know, and I say, yes ma'am, cool.
So thank you to Matthew for sharing that story.
Yeah, and just as a reminder for our audience, you've probably heard Matthew and Phyllis before. They both appeared on season 1 of the show, so we are so glad to welcome them both back for this episode.
And Matthew last season shared with us a really important connection that he had made with animals and how important animals were in his life. So he seems to kind of be coming up in our episodes that are about connection and community.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, his story today, the things that it made me think of was the importance around access to accessible public transportation, which we know is a huge barrier for so many people with disabilities and for people who are low income, people who don't have cars. You know, there are all sorts of reasons why having a robust public transportation system is essential for living your life.
Yeah. I mean, according to the Council on Quality and Leadership, 30% of people with disabilities have trouble with transportation.
Yeah, that is 10 times higher than the non-disabled population reporting to that same question. I mean, that's ridiculous. 30% of people struggle with access to transportation. And that could be for a whole bunch of different reasons. It could be you live in a rural area, you don't have public transportation. It could be that the cost of the kind of transportation that you have available to you, like taxis or Ubers, is outside of what you can afford. Sometimes Medicaid waivers cover transportation. Sometimes they don't. Depends on the state. Depends on your circumstances.
It depends on how complicated the systems are, mm-hmm. how many transfers you have to make to get from one place to another. That can be really confusing and disorienting for people.
Yeah. And just like all other service systems, the transportation service system right now is really overburdened, which means that often the kinds of transportation that is prioritized are transportation to medical appointments or transportation to work, which means that if you want to be in your community, that might not be something that you have access to, even if you have access to transportation.
I think it's important to remind people, though, that not all people with disabilities and not all people with intellectual disabilities rely on public transportation. Some people do drive, but there are barriers to getting driver's licenses.
Yeah, absolutely. And so because there are barriers, there are also some really cool programs that help people navigate those barriers. And we'll just shout out locally, the University of Toledo actually has one of these programs to help enable people with developmental disabilities to access their driver's license through things like extra support as you're preparing for those tests.
Which is really awesome. So thinking about how much some of those tests rely on literacy, for instance, mm-hmm. and reading in a particular way at a particular pace on a computer screen.
Great.
Right.
Things that have nothing to do with driving.
Correct.
Yeah. So just thinking about, you know, wherever there are barriers, there are also people who are coming up with these really creative solutions to navigate them.
Well, before we end today, I want to thank our contributors, Phyllis and Matthew, our associate producer, Connor Smenner, our intern, Ava Gottschalk, and our Telling It Our Way advisory board members, Jarita Fox, Quinn Thomas, and Gavin Daly.
And special thanks to WGTE and our producer, Chris Pfeiffer. To access transcripts for our show and any other show notes, please visit wgte.org/ourway.
I'm Allie Day.
And I'm Becca Monteleone, and you've been listening to Telling It Our Way.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.